This is Jeff Blankford welcoming you to the May 11th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. While U.S.-led NATO forces and Russian forces are engaged in building up their respective militaries on either side of Russia's western border, the ultranationalist fascist forces that were instrumental in the overthrow of Ukraine's elected president, Viktor Yanukovych, in 2014 have been flexing their muscles in Odessa. They have predictably received little attention from the U.S. media, which have downplayed their role in producing the third regime change involving the Obama presidency. Given their position in Ukraine's crumbling economy and the emergence of similar forces across Eastern and Central Europe, the importance of Ukraine's ultra-right should not be ignored or minimized. Today, at 20 minutes past the hour, I'll be speaking about that subject and other related issues with Professor Nikolai Petrov from the University of Rhode Island, one of the country's foremost authorities on Russia and Ukraine affairs. Before I get to that, a little refresher on how a 21st century version of the Cold War came to be, which I reported to you back in 2014. It may be helpful. In December 2013, U.S. Deputy Secretary of State for Europe, Victoria Nuland Kagan, spoke to the Ukrainian American Foundation in Washington and boasted that the United States had spent $5.1 billion on its efforts to overthrow the government in Ukraine, although the terms she used were a bit more diplomatic. I played the audio of her speech for you at the time, and you can still find it on YouTube. I also played for you a secretly tape recording of Nuland Kagan and Jeff Pyatt, the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine at the time, discussing who should be the country's prime minister following the coup against Ukraine's elected president, as the two have been openly plotting, aided by the U.S. NGOs on the ground in Kiev. Not surprisingly, following the coup, Nuland Kagan's choice, Arseniy Yatsenyuk, got the job. That audio as well can still be found online. What should be noted is that Nuland Kagan was Hillary Clinton's press spokesperson while the former First Lady was Secretary of State, and should Clinton make it to the White House, it is more than likely she'll be appointed to a high-level foreign policy position. No less important is it that she is married to Robert Kagan, co-founder of the Project for a New American Century, the neocon think tank that brought us the Iraq War and whose attitude towards Russia has not changed since the collapse of the Soviet Union. Robert Kagan has already endorsed Clinton's nomination, and that should really come as no surprise because her foreign policy positions are identical to those of Kagan and most of his fellow neocons. That Clinton would hire Nuland Kagan as her spokesperson and that Obama would later appoint her as his Deputy Secretary of State for Europe and Asia points to how little actual change there has been between the Bush and Obama administrations when it comes to foreign policy. It's important to recall Nuland Kagan's actions in Ukraine now because what it set in motion was the current confrontation between a remilitarized Russia and a re-energized NATO on its borders. This required NATO breaking an oral agreement that had been made with the Russians back in 1990 as part of its agreeing to the reunification of Germany that it would keep its distance from Russia's borders. Washington, as NATO allies, blamed Russia's annexation of Russian-speaking Crimea for today's heightened confrontation and as an excuse for moving its troops eastward, but NATO had in fact broken its word to the Russians 5 years earlier. It's worth mentioning that Crimea had been part of Russia from 1783 to 1954, at which time Ukrainian-born Prime Minister Nikita Khrushchev arbitrarily transferred it over to the Ukrainian Socialist Republic while maintaining it as part of the Soviet Union. This fact was rarely mentioned by Western media. Back in 2009, then-Russian President Dmitry Medvedev had accused the West of breaking its promises regarding respect for Russia's borders. Washington and its NATO allies denied that any commitment had been made regarding the movement of its troops during the critical discussions over German reunification. It was the Russians who were telling the truth, however, as Germany's Der Spiegel magazine revealed, when newly discovered documents in Western archives supported Moscow's position. On February 10th, 1990, Between 4 and 6:30 p.m., Der Spiegel noted, German Foreign Minister Hans-Dietrich Genscher spoke with his Russian counterpart, Eduard Shevardnadze. According to the German record of the conversation, that had only recently been declassified, Genscher said, quote, "We are aware that NATO membership for unified Germany raises complicated questions. For us, however, one thing is certain, NATO will not expand to the east," end quote. And because the conversation revolved mainly around East Germany, Genscher added explicitly, quote, "As far as the non-expansion of NATO is concerned, this also applies in general," end quote. Shevardnadze replied that he believed, quote, "everything the minister," Genscher, "had said." Moreover, Mikhail Gorbachev claimed that Secretary of State James Baker had made the same commitment to him, and the expansion of NATO violated the spirit of agreements that unfortunately were not put in writing. To bring you up to date, Russia's Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu said last Wednesday that Russia will deploy 3 divisions of troops along its borders to counter NATO's increasing military presence in Eastern Europe. Meanwhile, U.S. Secretary of War Ash Carter said last week that NATO is considering stationing a force of around 4,000 troops in Poland and the 3 Baltic states, Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia. This would be in addition to another deployment already authorized, the U.S. Armored Brigade, about 4,200 troops that will be sent to Eastern Europe in February. Carter said on Monday that the additional Eastern European force NATO is considering would consist of 4 battalions of soldiers contributed by NATO members on a continuously rotating basis. Meanwhile, in the wars of the Middle East that have no foreseeable end, a note of unwarranted optimism emerged. It was as connected to reality as what those in the mid-1960s heard from U.S. officials concerning the progress of the war on Vietnam. Quote, "So far in terms of what we had hoped to do, we are pretty much on track," said a U.S. official quoted in the Washington Post, who spoke on the condition of anonymity in order to discuss sensitive subjects. "We are actually a little bit ahead of where we wanted to be," he said. However, according to the Post article, quote, "the fight is entering what Pentagon officials have called a new and potentially harder phase, one that will entail a deeper level of U.S. involvement, but also tougher targets." In an attempt to ramp up the tempo of the war, the article goes on, the U.S. military is escalating its engagement, dispatching an additional 450 special operations forces and other troops to Syria and Iraq, deploying hundreds of Marines close to the front lines in Iraq, and bringing Apache attack helicopters and B-52s into service for the air campaign. You remember the B-52s. They were used to bomb Vietnam back to the Stone Age, and they're still around, while the unindicted war criminals who ordered them into the air were allowed to retire or die in peace. Well, the extra resources, the Post article continues, are an acknowledgement, U.S. officials say, that the war can't be won without a greater level of American involvement. The targets that lie ahead are those that are the most important to the militant self-proclaimed caliphate, including their twin capitals of Raqqa in Syria and Mosul in Iraq, and to a lesser extent, Fallujah, a key concern because of its proximity to Baghdad, end quote. Wrong. Fallujah should be a key concern to all Americans because it was a site of the first use by U.S. forces of weapons containing depleted uranium, the first in modern warfare. It devastated the people of that city far more cruelly than ISIS has done, and it was the Democratic Party leadership from the Obama White House to both houses of Congress that allowed the criminals responsible to get away with it. As Dar Jamal reported on Democracy Now 3 years ago, quote, "noting the birth defects in the Iraqi city of Fallujah, they're extremely hard to bear witness to, but it's something that we all need to pay attention to. What this has generated is, from 2004 up to this day," said Jamil, "we are seeing a rate of congenital malformation in the city of Fallujah that has surpassed even that in the wake of the Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki that nuclear bombs were dropped on at the end of World War II," end quote. Yes, it was something that we all need to pay attention to, and yet we didn't. Listeners of Sunday's Weekend Edition on NPR, particularly the nearly 500 residents of Mendocino County who showed up at Ukiah's Convention Center Saturday to hear Hawaiian Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard speak on behalf of Bernie Sanders' presidential candidacy, were, I suspect, more than a little miffed. That's when they heard NPR's national correspondent Mara Liasson announce that, despite whatever happens in the remaining primary contest, and even if the party superdelegates vote the way their respective states have done up to now, it is, she said, quote, mathematically impossible for Sanders to get the nomination, unquote. While Senator Sanders' chances of getting the nomination at this point are admittedly slim, Liasson's statement was simply not true. What it reflected, as she demonstrated again yesterday and this morning, chipping in with additional comments denigrating the Sanders candidacy, is the thinly disguised efforts of the media establishment, of which NPR and Liasson are signature members, to snuff out Sanders' historic presidential run and anoint Hillary Clinton as a Democratic nominee and the country's next president. A story in the online journal Political Monday told a different story. It reported that Clinton had resumed running TV ads on the eve of yesterday's West Virginia primary, concluding that, quote, Clinton's campaign is eager to stop Sanders from gaining momentum with a string of victories through May, end quote. I suspect they're even more eager today after Sanders' drubbing of Clinton in the Mountaineer state. What must be worrying her and what might make the superdelegates think twice is that 4 out of 10 Sanders voters in West Virginia said they would support Trump if Clinton is the nominee. One superdelegate, our member of Congress, Jared Huffman, who initially indicated he would be supporting Clinton in Philadelphia, now says that he will vote for whoever has the most delegates coming into the convention. Should Sanders keep winning, particularly in California, it's more likely that other superdelegates will do the same by July's convention in Philadelphia. Despite lobbying efforts by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, it appears that Washington will take a tougher tone with Israel in an upcoming report that takes the Jewish state to task over the expanding of Jewish-only settlements in the West Bank, the resumption of demolitions of Palestinian homes, and the seizures of land belonging to the Palestinians that ostensibly would be theirs in a future state. That's according to 3 unnamed American diplomats who spoke with the Associated Press. The report to be issued by the U.S. and its fellow members of the so-called quartet, the UN, the EU, and Russia and the United States, will also chastise Palestinian leaders for failing to rein in anti-Israeli violence, but the diplomats involved in drafting the document said its primary focus will be the surge of construction in Jewish housing in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. According to the AP, the U.S. approval of the harsh language marks a subtle shift. Washington has traditionally tempered statements by the so-called quartet with careful diplomatic language, but the officials said the U.S. in this case will align itself closer to the positions of the European Union, Russia, and the UN, who have been more critical of Israel's role in the Mideast impasse. While, as the AP notes, the reports released later this month is sure to infuriate Israel, this announcement several weeks in advance seems guaranteed, if not designed, to stimulate Israel's friends in Congress, as well as presumptive presidential candidates Clinton and Trump, to rise in Israel's defense and pressure the State Department to water down the text in alignment with the wishes of AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, Israel's domestic lobby. The report will be largely symbolic, requiring no action, but it could be presented to the UN and possibly sent to the Security Council for an endorsement, according to the diplomats. According to the AP, they demanded anonymity because they weren't authorized to discuss the unfinished work publicly. Now, that would seem to be a serious leak of critical information from within the State Department, would it not? But does anyone seriously think the leakers will be hunted down and punished? I don't think so. Now, according to the Israeli paper Haaretz, the quartet's report has largely become a Washington affair, with an American, Frank Lowenstein, taking the lead in drafting it, although U.N. Special Envoy Nikolai Mladenov and EU Envoy Ferdinando Gentilini reportedly were said to have offered suggestions. This week, the quartet delegates are meeting in Moscow to unify the various drafts so as to make the final document ready for the foreign ministers' summit in Paris on May 25th. This presumably gives the members of Congress as well as Clinton and Trump plenty of time to weigh in. Meanwhile, on the eve of the bid to have her church divest from companies allegedly profiting from Israel's control of the West Bank, Clinton has reasserted that the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement targeting Israel's settlement policy is counterproductive to peace. Clinton was responding on Sunday to an appeal from the Israel Action Network, an affiliate of the Jewish Federations of North America, ahead of the quadrennial United Methodist Church General Conference that started yesterday in Portland, Oregon. In a two-page message, Clinton, who was raised and remains a practicing Methodist, did not directly mention the church, but repeated what she had previously told AIPAC's National Convention, quote, that BDS seeks to punish Israel and dictate how the Israelis and Palestinians should resolve the core issues of their conflict, end quote. Meanwhile, in Israel, a portion of Holocaust Remembrance Day speech by one of Israel's highest-ranking officers has caused a furor that has yet to die down. Elements of General Yair Golan's speech drew so much harsh criticism that in some cases it complained, a Jerusalem Post writer, they overshadow the actual meaning of Holocaust Remembrance Day. What did Golan say? He said, quote, "The Holocaust should bring us together and ponder our public lives, and furthermore, it must lead anyone who is capable of taking public responsibility to do so. Because if there is one thing that is scary in remembering the Holocaust, it is noticing horrific processes which develop in Europe, particularly in Germany, 70, 80, and 90 years ago, and finding remnants of that here among us in the year 2016. Under withering criticism, Golan backpedaled, saying that he did not mean to compare Israel or the general, or the Israel Defense Forces to the Nazis. Yet the Nazis fall into the time frame he discussed, noted the Jerusalem Post critic. Even accepting his clarification, they wrote, Germany 70, 80, 90 years ago was just too close for comfort to a Nazi comparison for many, especially on Holocaust Remembrance Day when we're mourning the 6 million Jews they murdered, end quote. Golan had one supporter in Environmental Protection Minister Avi Gabay. The Jerusalem Post quoted Gabay as pointing out that Major General Golan has enough perspective to be granted our attention without everyone pouncing on him. The harsh criticism is out of place. There is nothing similar between Israel today and what happened in the Holocaust, but there is definitely the budding signs of nationalism and racism that is reminiscent of Germany in the 20s and 30s, end quote. For anyone who has seen the YouTubes online of crowds of young Israeli men and women shouting death to the Arabs, that can be classified as an understatement. This is Jeff Blankfort. Thank you for listening. My guest today, Professor Nikolai Petro, has a long and distinguished record in the field of Russian and Ukraine studies, about which I can best only tell you a little. After receiving his BA, MA, and PhD in Foreign Affairs from the University of Virginia in 1984, Professor Petro founded the Center for Contemporary Russian Studies at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies in Monterey. In 1989 and 1990, as an International Affairs Fellow of the Council of Foreign Relations, he served as Special Assistant for Policy in the Office of Soviet Union Affairs at the State Department and as Temporary Political Attaché at the Embassy in Moscow. While in the Soviet Union, he monitored local elections in Russia, Belarus, and Latvia. In 2001 and 2002, he returned to Russia as a private citizen to serve as staff consultant to the Inadmissible Research and Training Center Dialogue and advisor to the mayor of the Russian city of Novgorod the Great. His postdoctoral awards include two Fulbrights, one to Russia and one to Ukraine, a Thornton D. Hooper International Affairs Fellowship at the Foreign Policy Research Institute, and research awards from the National Council for Eurasian and East European Research, the Kennan Institute for Advanced Russian Studies in Washington, and the Hoover Institution at Stanford. He has written a half dozen books and numerous articles on Russia and Ukraine, and will be the guest editor of a special issue of European Politics and Society to be out next month entitled Ukraine in Crisis, which is a subject we'll explore today. It's a great pleasure to welcome Professor Nikolai Petro to Takes on the World.
Hello.
Very glad to have you here. I want to begin by asking you to tell our listeners about an important event that took place 2 years ago, last May 2nd, following the U.S.-supported coup in Ukraine that most Americans know nothing about, a terrorist attack by right-wing Ukraine nationalists on a trade union office in Odessa that killed 48 workers and wounded another 200, which you described in an article on Counterpunch this past April 28th.
So this is one of the key events of the new Ukraine, marking sort of the transition between the old regime and the new policies of the new government. As you mentioned, May 2nd, 2014, there was a confrontation between radicals who came into the city from other regions and local activists from mostly from Odessa. Clashes took place in the center of the city and then moved from the center of the city to the area downtown where the trade union building is. And after storming and getting rid of a tent city that had been set up there and forcing the activists to flee into the trade union building, it was firebombed by Molotov cocktails, resulting in the deaths of at least 48 people and scores of injured. This event is under investigation. There have been a lot of commissions set up in Ukraine to investigate it, but there has been no progress to date on finding out who is responsible or bringing anyone to justice. And this is one of the big frustrations, I would say, particularly in the Novgorod region, with the current government and with law enforcement in general. So last year there was a commemoration, peaceful commemoration of this event, trying to push for some sort of investigation. This year, no commemoration was allowed. What happened was that the main square in front of the trade union building was occupied by the police, and no one was allowed to enter it on the date, on the time set for the commemoration. Local judges had allowed a commemoration to take place, but the police prevented it, arguing that there was bomb threats, and there were bomb threats throughout the day. And in addition, the rest of the city was basically put on lockdown by having an additional 3,000 to 3,500 National Guard troops brought into the city. And as a result, partly of these measures, and partly, I think, of the common sense of many Odessans who didn't want any confrontation with authorities or any confrontation that would get out of hand, the situation was quite peaceful, even though the commemorations were prevented. The interesting thing about this particular date is that it falls within a week of what many Ukrainians and people throughout the former Soviet Union consider one of their major national holidays, which is Victory Day of Soviet forces in Europe, which is May 9th. So this, too, since it occurs so close to May 2nd, becomes a time when people rally to explain their discomfort with the attempts of the current regime to rewrite history and to sever the traditionally close relations between Ukraine and Russia.
What is remarkable is the lack of coverage this event received in the mainstream media at the time. And even the Los Angeles Times wrote that there were snipers inside the building, as if the people, the victims, were the ones who were the perpetrators.
Well, we don't know. The Los Angeles Times can't honestly or legitimately say that because we don't have any official findings. As I said, there have been three commissions locally and two commissions in the parliament, but both the Council of Europe and the United Nations rapporteur have pointed out that there has been no conclusion to the official investigation, no data released. The responsibility for the investigation was transferred from the Odessa region to Kiev, and only last month, after they did nothing to promote the investigation in Kiev, did they send it back to Odessa. And the very first public public press conference by the chief police officer in charge took place 2 weeks ago to answer questions about how the investigation was proceeding, and basically to tell everybody that they'd really just begun the investigation. But in the meantime, a lot of the information, as several analysts have noted who are familiar with this incident, a lot of material has been lost, a lot of material has been designated as secret. So there are a variety of conspiracy theories, and it's unfortunate that some of these conspiracy theories become then related as, well, this is what actually happened, even in reputable Western news outlets.
Well, it is, for me, as I say, bewildering, because I tell you, Frank, when I read your article, and I have been following the situation in Ukraine, I thought closely. I did not remember it. I confess I did not remember it. And this was a major event, and if it ISIL had done it, it would have been all over the headlines of the Western press. Or if it had been done by some outfit that the United States puts on its terrorist list. But I find that even the coverage of the events taking place in Maidan during the protest and before the overthrow of Yanukovych, that the role of these ultra-right nationalists had been played down. And one of the things I've noticed since this time, for other reasons, but the rise of the ultra-right throughout Europe, and wonder if you see the connections between this, what we have in Ukraine, and what we have in Hungary, Austria, other countries like that.
I don't know enough about the character of right-wing or nationalist movements in other countries to make a comparison. What I can say is that, in my opinion, nationalist groups, and I would go so far as to call them radical nationalists, because as opposed to people that one might colloquially designate as patriots, these people whom I call radical nationalists, specifically focus on removing Russian influence from Ukrainian culture, language, culture, tourist ties, literature, not political pressure, not economic, but really trying to sever any kind of connection. And in order to do that, they have to promote a view of Russia as the antithesis of everything that is Ukrainian. And Ukrainian is good, and therefore everything that Russia is or stands for, any person speaking the Russian language, it doesn't matter if you're Ukrainian or not, that in and of itself makes you a potential traitor to to their cause. So it's a really Manichaean black and white view of the world. And these groups have elected officials in the parliament. They exert an inordinate influence, not proportionate to their numbers, but much greater than the relatively small number of elected officials they have in the parliament, because they are a very vocal, very aggressive group, and their prominence, their influence in the political system, I believe, is one of the reasons that Ukraine has backed away from implementing the Minsk peace accords. Because on the one hand, the government seems to have signed these accords, now more than a year old, but it has been unable to consistently implement the steps within them, which are very clear, because to do so would provoke the anger of these radical groups, many of which are armed, they have their own militias, they act independently, or they promise to act independently, in any case, of the official forces of law and order. So they constitute a law unto themselves. And this is very, very dangerous, I think, for the political stability and ultimately for any aspirations Ukraine may have to integrate into the European legal and political system.
Well, you wrote an earlier article in March I found quite interesting, Why Ukraine Needs Russia More Than Ever, that its economic survival depends on its relations with Russia. And I recall before Yanukovych was overthrown that Vladimir Putin had offered Ukraine a much better deal in terms of a loan, no interest loan, I believe it was, of $15 billion, to take care temporarily of Ukraine's terrible economic situation. But he, the Ukrainians and then Poroshenko elected to go with a much stiffer deal, much more difficult arrangement, more expensive arrangement with the European Union. And now today, the Ukrainian economy is crumbling. Perhaps you comment on that.
Well, the interesting fact about the Ukrainian economic statistics is that after a policy of trying to sever economic ties, of promoting independence on every possible arena with respect to Russia, Russia remains Ukraine's single largest trading partner. And I just took that fact and reminded readers of it and said, well, how is this country going to prosper if it doesn't have mutually beneficial trade relations with its much larger and much wealthier neighbor? It would be like Canada saying, well, we don't want to trade with the United States because of, you know, all the bad things that America wants to do to us. No Canadian government official could pursue such a policy because it would make everything in the Canadian economy that much more expensive. But this, to me, since this similar policy in Ukraine really, to me, highlights the ideological nature of what they're trying to accomplish. They're trying to promote an economic policy that is not in the actual best interests of the Ukrainian consumer, but is oriented toward creating a rift with Russia that can never be healed. And this is something that really the EU, which would like Ukraine to be prosperous and independent of Russia and would like to be able to have good ties with it, this is not something that the EU thinks is rational. It's willing to support Ukraine for some time, but really, in the long run, there is no alternative but to have good trade and economic relations and hopefully diplomatic and political relations with your biggest neighbor. Any other approach seems to me very nearsighted and counterproductive.
Well, one thing that occurred to me is seeing the relative neglect that now Ukraine has in the mainstream media, even from our politicians, that whether intentional or not, the confrontation that followed when Putin had the vote in Crimea and then annexed it and brought it back into the Russian sphere served to pump up what seemed to be a North American, North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, that had run out of reasons for existence. Now it's flexing its muscles, and the Ukraine confrontation with Russia has given a NATO new life.
Yes. Well, NATO had a difficult rationale for its existence as a military bloc if it wasn't doing anything militarily. So NATO has always had two components. One is a civilian military, a civilian diplomatic component, which includes things like, you know, cultural exchanges and things like that. But a lot of that is duplicated by other European institutions and some transatlantic institutions like the Atlantic Council. But the thing that has always set NATO apart from other institutions, it was a military pact. And the rationale for its creation was to serve as a defensive deterrent against Soviet aggression. So when the Soviet pact that was set up later than NATO, 6 years later, the Warsaw Pact disbanded, the rationale for NATO as a military organization became unclear. So among the NATO constituencies, among the NATO lobby groups, I think the interpretation, the narrative that what Russia is doing is a war of aggression in Ukraine, which is changing the status quo in Europe, is very handy for the military side of NATO, which we can look at the trends in expenditures has been declining. Now, for the very first time, I hear, the German military will be expanding in size. A number of countries whose percentage of GNP spend on the military had fallen to less than 2% are at least considering the possibility of raising it to 2%. So as long as that narrative of a aggressive Russia can be preserved in the public mind, there will be support for this kind of expenditure. I think in the long run, though, it's not likely to be preserved, because people asking themselves about how to spend taxpayers' money in places like Holland or France or even Finland and Sweden look at their options and say, okay, well, let's say Russia was aggressive and is conducting an aggressive war, and we have Crimea as an example, and then we look at Donbass in the eastern Ukraine, and there's clearly some level of involvement and support in something that we call a hybrid war. But why isn't there more? In other words, there seems to have been a freezing of the conflict once specific objectives were obtained. So now the question becomes for NATO, well, what are we doing? Are we preventing further aggression? But where's the proof of the further aggression? Or are we? Is our expenditure aimed at pushing Russia back taking the fight to Russia and liberating eastern Ukraine and Crimea. No, no, no. That's clearly not the objective, say, politicians and NATO members. So we seem to not have a clear strategy as to what this additional expenditure is designed exactly to accomplish. And I would say the same thing is true for our policy on sanctions. Our sanctions policy is aimed to send a message. Okay, well, how long does it take to send a message to Russia? 2 years? Are we still sending the same message? Well, then that wasn't a very effective message if they haven't gotten it in 2 years. It really makes very little sense, which is why I think you have some very notable people in the United States, for example, not to mention Europe, but former Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel, former U.S. Defense Secretary William Perry, and even some presidential candidates saying that, well, we need to sit down with Russia, with the Russian leadership, and have a clear discussion and try to get over our differences and set our relations on a better course than they have been these last 2 years.
My guest is Professor Nikolai Petro, and we are talking about the situation now between Russia and Ukraine. One thing that seems to me, in looking at the whole situation, is that the United States was essentially following the neocon agenda in its approach toward Russia, which still sees Russia as an old Soviet Union and the Cold War, and that simply they want to maintain this kind of confrontation standing. And the American public is really not even a part of this conversation, that they're frightened. They keep seeing words like Russian aggression, Russian invasion of Ukraine. But these seems to be, at the very minimum, an out-of-hand exaggeration. What do you think about the neocon role in this? If you have to comment on that.
I guess I see the logic of saying that in the absence of a policy that can envision, that can even imagine Russia as a friend of the West, it is natural for our relations to fall back to the familiar traditional patterns of hostility. So we've had 25 years since the collapse of communism. And at the time, at least when I was in school, I remember being told that our enmity was not with Russia and the Russian people, or their values, but with the communist system. So that, logically, if the communist system were ended, then our values would lead us to closer interaction and a new type of relationship. But unfortunately, that never took hold. We simply had a generation of people, and that's the same generation that we still have running for president, including, for example, Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump, and even Bernie Sanders. These are all people for whom Russia is the Soviet Union. I mean, they have no other language through which to describe the country that they grew up being told was their enemy because of the communist system. Now, the communist system has been dead and buried for a long time, but because information about Russia focuses on everything that tends to be negative about it, it's not at all clear that they're able to come up with an alternative perception of Russia. And before we can have a new policy, we have to be able to understand how much the country has changed. And until we get that message through the media, well, we have what is in essence a self-fulfilling prophecy with our foreign policy. We see the enemy we want to see.
Now, it's interesting that one of your articles, the first article, was on Counterpunch, and the article on why Ukraine needs Russia more than ever was on the London Guardian.
Right.
How open is the U.S. mainstream media to hearing another viewpoint?
Well, there are editorial positions which seem to me very clearly delineated in major outlets. Having said that, it has been my experience that if one has a point of contact within the establishment, one can approach that person, and if that person sees you as reasonable and is open to the idea that there could be a different point of view, they could potentially publish something that you write. But it is to write, say, for the to send off an article to the New York Times or the Washington Post or the Wall Street Journal or the Financial Times just with a novel idea or novel interpretation without doing the careful legwork of making sure that it gets to the right person in the editorial staff, that that person knows you, that that person knows of your credentials, that's basically futile. I wrote these kind of op-ed pieces and sent them off, for example, to the Washington Post for 20 years and never got any insight. But once I met people on the editorial board of other major American newspapers, then they simply take you see you as a viable alternative, and there may be room for alternative points of view occasionally. But the amount of press that someone with the view that Russia is not entirely at fault, or that they have a point of view that I might get, or that someone much more distinguished than I in the field of Russian studies or Soviet studies could get, like a Stephen Cohen, has been sharply, sharply reduced. Because unfamiliar arguments cannot be easily processed. I think that's the way I would explain it. If you start with a very different premise about what the problem is, what the solution is, you know, it's like arguing about creationism at a convention of scientists. You know, it's like you're on a very different planet, and there's just simply no way to take your arguments at face value, no matter what your academic credentials are.
Well, it is interesting, though, is that it seems, and I grew up during the World War II and the Cold War, that this particular group of characters, called the neocons, were working behind the scenes. I mentioned earlier, but I played 2 years ago the recordings of Victoria Nuland, whose husband Kagan, Robert Kagan, is a founder of the Project for New American Century, was already endorsed to Hillary Clinton. I played her speech to the Ukrainian American Foundation, which she bragged about the billions the U.S. had already spent on trying to change the government of Ukraine, and then the conversation that was recorded with the ambassador Jeff Pyatt about their plans for post-coup Ukraine and how she picked Yatsenyuk to be the prime minister, and that's who he turned out to be. It sounds like a board game, which the Ukrainians were just chess pieces on the board. for some other outside party's benefit. And now that Ukraine essentially done, it's pushed to the side, and yet they've left something behind there that, as you describe it, is getting uglier by the minute.
Well, their American involvement in and EU involvement in the political process of Ukraine and its administration is far from over. It's one of those things that is widely discussed in the Ukrainian press, and it's basically taken for granted that there is an American or an EU curator in pretty much every administrative office in Ukraine, in the Ukrainian government. But the perspective, why this is desirable or necessary, I mean, there are arguments that you call them neocons, they can be called cold warriors. I suppose people like that would define themselves as American exceptionalists. You remember Madeleine Albright's famous statement that America does intervene aggressively throughout the world because of its special character, because we see farther than other nations what their true interests are. And if you take that point of view as your point of departure about the unique beneficence of America and American foreign policy, then what you're doing is a happy, in foreign countries like Ukraine, is a happy coincidence between things that support or advantage American foreign policy, but also in the long run will help Ukrainians. And those who see it as foreign intervention are simply unenlightened about their own best interests. It's not something that you can sort of discuss on the level of practical rationality, but rather it becomes a debate over visions of the world which has very messianic and religious overtones about America's mission to the world. So I would be wary.
Very frightening
of politicians
prospect.
Who adopt
yes.
this.
Yes, I'm. I'm in watching our two candidates. Indeed, Trump is all over the place, but Madam Clinton seems actually ready to go on the first day with a no-fly zone over Syria and has learned nothing from her previous forays into Libya and elsewhere.
And I would expect that because of her much vaunted experience, she is actually very much settled in her ways. If you read some of the critiques, there have been some excellent critiques of her foreign policy out there by Andrew Bacevich Jr., by Anatole Lieben, a famous article called "The Hawk Named Hillary." We know essentially what her foreign policy would be. The only, aside from leaving aside Senator Sanders, who doesn't look like he will be the candidate, the most likely Republican nominee, Donald Trump, is a much more of an uncertainty. People seem to be able to read into his views and his statements whatever they want to hear. And even people who have a desire for improving relations with Russia can look at his foreign his few foreign policy statements and take comfort from those views, because they are indeed not as settled and at least appear to display a bit more flexibility and originality in the interpretation of American interests than those of former Secretary of State Clinton.
And at that point, interesting point, we have so much to look forward to or not look forward to. I want to thank you very much, Professor Nikolai Petrov, for being our guest on Takes on the World. And you have a website, NikolaiPetrov.com, correct?
www.npetro.net.
Dot net.
Right.
Okay.
NPETRO.net.
Well, thank you so much for being our guest today and sharing your thoughts.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
This is Jeff Blankford. Thank you for listening.